You know, I saw what was to me a little bit startling and frightening demonstration a couple months back, where it was about architecture. And the way it works was that, okay, here's my plot of land, and here's where the sewer connections and the electrical connections, here's where I want my driveway. And then you just told the AI architect, now I would like a house in the style of Frank Lloyd Wright with 5 bedrooms and 3 bathrooms. And then you waited 30 seconds and then plunk.
Welcome to the DuPage Business Beat, a podcast about today's biggest business issues told from a Chicagoland perspective. Hello, Chicagoland. Welcome to the DuPage Business Beat. I'm Greg Bedloff, President and CEO of Choose DuPage and host of today's podcast. Today, I am extremely pleased to welcome U.S. Congressman Bill Foster to the show. Since 2013, Congressman Foster has represented the 11th Congressional District of Illinois. He is both a scientist and a businessman, and he holds the distinction of being the only PhD in Congress. Congressman Foster, welcome to our podcast.
Happy to be here, Greg.
Thanks so much for joining us. Congressman, I know before you became a member of Congress, you worked as a high-energy physicist, particle accelerator designer at Fermilab, and you were a member of the team that discovered the top quark, the heaviest form known in matter. And you also led the team that designed and built several scientific facilities and detectors that are still in use today, including the anti-proton recycler ring, which is the latest of Fermilab's giant particle accelerators. And you also have a history in business where you started a business, I believe, in your basement.
Yep. I started with, well, my little brother and I was 19 years old, and my little brother, who was 17, we wrangled $500 out of my parents to start this business. We had the bright idea of using the newly invented microprocessor to control theater stage lights, which had never been done before. So all the time in high school, I was sort of the science guy who was building computers out of logic chips and so on. My little brother was the theater guy. Who did that so he wouldn't have to compete academically against my elder sister and me. And so that at one point we had a conversation and realized that the sort of equipment that was being sold for $100,000, including to the University of Wisconsin, could probably be reproduced on a much better device for about $500 in parts. So we thought maybe there was a business model there. A year later, we had a prototype and began selling it through other companies that were established players, because, you know, no one's going to buy theater lighting controllers from a bunch of teenage kids, because if it ever dies after you've sold $100,000 of tickets, it's not a good situation. But our equipment was very reliable, and one of the established companies just slapped their label on it and sold it for several years.
Okay.
And so when we got our first order, we moved from we started out in our basement, and then Dad kicked us out for making too much of a mess, and then we moved to my bedroom. And then when we got our first order, we moved to a tiny little metal shed in a cornfield, and now the business is a great big metal building in a cornfield with 1,300 employees, and manufactures more than half of all of the theater lighting equipment in the United States.
And you mentioned to me earlier that it's now an ESOP.
That's right. And so
behind that.
So when I decided to get into politics about 15 years ago now, I asked my partners to buy me out because I simply didn't want to be casting votes in Congress that affected my net worth. Now, it may shock you, but that's actually a problem in Congress. But I didn't want to be anywhere near it. And so my partners bought me out before I began serving in Congress. And then then one of the last decisions that we made before I, you know, left my ownership of the company was to begin the transition towards an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan, where, you know, for the last 15 years, the employees have been getting part of their compensation in shares of stock. And as of the first of this year, the company is now 100% owned by the employees.
That's fantastic. And how are the employees feeling about being business owners? It hopefully sets a bit of an entrepreneurial spirit within their own self. Yeah.
Well, I've talked to ESOPs in the 11th District in Illinois, and you know, that's a almost universal thing with employee-owned companies, that they really work well. There's some things you have to be careful of in structuring your business that way.
Sure.
But it's a very good way to handle the generational handoff of companies. Very often there's a founder or a set of founders who are, you know, the heroes of the business, but their children aren't really too interested in following on. And so that transitioning to an employee stock ownership plan is really a very good way of handling that.
So where does Fermilab fit into that timeline? Because I know that you've heard me say it before. In DuPage County, we are proud of the fact that we're home to not one, and I've heard you say it, that we're home to not only one but two national laboratories here in DuPage. And we often think of these national laboratories as these secretive places behind these fences with barbed wire and security all over the place. But there's so much more than that. And how did the transition for you, or when did the transition for you happen with respect to Fermi?
Yeah, well, I ended up running the company for most of a decade, and then I returned to my first love, which was physics. And so I went back to Harvard and got a PhD in particle physics. After I got my PhD thesis, I looked around at where the best particle physics in the world was being done. That was at Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory. For all of the 23 years that I was at Fermilab, we were smashing protons and antiprotons together to make particles that have not been around since the Big Bang.
Okay.
I spent the first 10 or 15 years there designing the particle physics detectors. When the particles smash into each other, you get a huge spray of particles. You have to analyze that spray to figure out what was created momentarily in that collision. That's how you discover the top quark. It's a single subatomic particle that weighs more than an entire atom of gold.
Wow.
And for various theoretical reasons, it's probably going to be the heaviest particle that will ever be discovered. So when I was in Congress, actually, when the discovery of the Higgs boson made news, and we had a big reception honoring many of my old collaborators when they had gone to Europe and discovered the Higgs boson, I congratulated them all at having discovered the second most massive particle.
We're number one.
That's right.
So now here you are in Congress, and you recognize as much as anybody the role that our national laboratories play, not only in our local and regional, but our national economy. Can you speak to a little bit about your belief in that and why the national labs are so critical for our future and for the economy, not only of DuPage County, but for all of the country?
Sure. Well, in the Illinois 11th District, I am very proud that I represent Argonne Lab and Fermi National Accelerator Lab.
I know that.
And so it's there's a long list of incredible discoveries that were made, not so much because scientists were interested in the economic implications of it, but we had another problem to solve. For example, if you fly into O'Hare from the west, you'll see these, or look on Google Earth at Fermilab, you'll see these two giant rings.
Yes.
In one of those two rings, we built the first superconducting particle accelerator that had ever been built. And, you know, when we were constructing it, the whole world was laughing at us because this is never, ever going to work. And so we would go and give talks at CERN, at the big particle accelerator physics at CERN, and they'd say, "You guys are nuts. You're betting the future of the laboratory on this unproven technology called superconducting synchrotrons." And we said, "Okay, just watch." And we built the Tevatron, it was called, and it worked. And then the whole world said, "Oh, we're going to copy that." So the big machine that CERN then built was basically a copy of the Tevatron, several times larger.
Wow. So then now from a congressional perspective, the labs are funded by tax dollars. What role do these national labs play in the future from a development perspective, whether it's AI, whether it's launching rockets, whether it's batteries, and all the things that are really critical to businesses, not only in DuPage, but the 11th District and beyond?
Yeah. Well, what the labs specialize in is pre-competitive research. Like, you know, the Elon Musk, the whole business with Tesla, was only possible because of lithium-ion batteries. And a lot of the technology for lithium-ion batteries was developed over decades at Argonne National Lab. So he would have had no product. And really, the if you look at the early history of Tesla, Elon Musk company, the federal government paid Well, he paid for his factory with a $500 million loan from the federal government. That was a big risk because no one had any idea whether or not you could make a usable car with the batteries that existed. But because of decades of federally funded research in the United States and in Japan and other places, there were there was a decent hope that what we think of as our laptop batteries could be made at scale and make a decent electric car, which is sort of what the Tesla proved and is just transforming automotive everything.
So maybe a bit of a leading question or a bit of a softball, but where's that come from within Bill Foster and that mindset of the government is doing some of the building blocks for this business? Is that the marriage of your business experience with your role in Congress to say we need to be supporting these businesses and we need to be on the cutting edge and the leading edge of defining new battery technology and new innovation that is going to continue our position in a global economy?
Yeah, it's the if you think back at my company, the thing that made it possible was microprocessor technology.
I thought what made it possible was $500 from your mom and dad.
Yeah, and the fact that a number of companies had been getting mostly military contracts for a long time to develop these cutting edge things called integrated circuits, or computer chips, mm-hmm. and it was only because of decades of federally funded in research into semiconductors that we got to the point where. In the Intel 8080 was finally a machine powerful enough to control theater lights.
And I know that you were one of the leading advocates in Congress for federal participation in the digital identity ecosystem. Tell us a little bit about that, your belief in that, why it's so critical as we move forward.
Yeah, well, I've been doing my best to warn Congress about the fact that AI was coming and that it was going to have a huge impact economically for more than the last 10 years, for all my time early that I've been in Congress. And if you look at where AI is right now and say, what can Congress do that will actually help? There's a handful of things. One of them has to do with the whole problem with deep fake impersonations and identity theft. There was most people have probably heard about these deep fake impersonations where they get videos of you and then change them so you're saying things you did not actually say or even more disruptive changes to those photographs. And so this technology, I've been watching it. I first programmed neural networks, the core thing, back at Fermilab in the 1990s. And so I've been watching this technology just sort of exponentially grow. It reminds me very much of, if you remember the early days of COVID, they said, oh, we've got 3 or 4 cases, up in the Northwest and in some, some senior homes in the Northwest or 3 or 4 or 10. And then people around the country said, oh, so what? It's 3 or 4 or 10. That's how big a deal is that? And all the scientists said, what's the doubling time? All right. And then they said the doubling time is between 2 and 4 days. And we said, OK, we're screwed because we saw the impact of an exponential increase. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've been seeing in artificial intelligence. And, there's no reason that is going to stop at the current level. It will continue to accelerate. And, frankly, we're not ready for that. But one of the things that we can do to prevent this deepfake impersonation is to everyone, when they hear about deepfakes, their first reaction is, let's imagine some magic software that can look at a video and tell you whether or not it's a deepfake. And my guess is that's a losing fight.
Well, how do you know if the software that's looking at the deepfake is legit software, legit. Right?
Wrote it yourself or mm-hmm. got it from a trusted source,
right.
The deepfakes are getting so much better so rapidly that it's going to be very, very hard, in my opinion. But now the thing that Congress can do is the other side of that coin, which is to provide people who wish with the ability to prove that they are who they say they are online and that they are not a deepfake impersonation of themselves. And this has been having a huge Right now I'm the lead Democrat on the committee with oversight over all banking and monetary policy. And, you know, banks and every financial firm are just terrified of deepfake impersonations. You're already seeing them being used to steal, you know, tens of millions of dollars from unsuspecting people. There was a big event a few months ago where a business was having a Zoom meeting. And the CFO of the company attended, and they discussed a project that they may want to get into. And at the end, they said, "Yep, okay, well, yeah, we should do the project." And then the CEO, who was also on the Zoom, ordered the CFO to go and transfer $25 million into this account to get it started. The CFO did not realize that everyone on that Zoom was a deepfake impersonation of their boss, of their coworkers, and everyone else. Wow. And $25 million got stolen from the company.
So what are the is the solution is that you're the champion of and that you're working towards? Is it a consent-based program?
Is it a mandated
program? And how do businesses find out more about it?
So the tool at hand for this are the so-called digital driver's licenses. And these are being implemented next year in Illinois. So by the end of next year, every citizen in Illinois will be able to get their Real ID compliant driver's license, which is a very powerful tool. And so in all of these, the databases, you know, your picture of your headshot, as they call it, and other information is stored by the individual states, but the states cooperate in a manner. So if you try to get a Real ID license in Illinois when you're already holding one in New Jersey, the states cooperate, you get discovered. And so this is something that is coming to Illinois. And what is going to be tremendously valuable about them is when you take your Real ID and you put it on your cell phone, because your cell phone can actually be used like a security dongle. The cell phone has what it's called trusted electronics inside it, where it can store some secret numbers that identify it as a unique device in the world, like a security dongle. You can then associate that with your Real ID driver's license. And then a modern cell phone is pretty good at identifying its owner. But you combine these three things, your cell phone, a Real ID, and your biometric authentication by your cell phone, and you have a really powerful way of proving you are who you say you are online and not a deepfake impersonation.
And for banks and other financial institutions, what does this mean for them in terms of digital identity and protecting and providing that information? I'm sure there's legal issues associated with that.
Yeah. Well, first off, it's a voluntary thing. No one has to use it. But, you know, for most people, the real threat to privacy is having someone impersonate you online rather than, oh, my God, there's this big database. Because most people know that your credit card companies and so on have a whole lot of information about you, or Google if you have a Gmail account. So this information exists. And the real threat is to have someone impersonate you and then steal all that information.
Right.
And so the fact that the digital driver's licenses that are being implemented in Illinois and at states around the country, this will reduce the amount of fraud tremendously. Now, for businesses, it's going to be great because one of the biggest cost for a fintech startup or even a small bank is the cost of onboarding customers and so-called know your customer requirements and just asking people to prove they are who they say they are and not some bad actor. You know, that's a complicated thing to set up, particularly for a small business or a small bank. And this would provide an automatic standard way.
Okay. So last question on this one. There's always going to be bad actors in the world. And every time you think you have a solution, somebody is working just as diligently as you are to try to find a new way to get into your digital world. Is there what's the enforcement mechanism? Are there fines associated with this? What does the government do once they get this information?
What this is going to do is make it much harder for these hackers to get an attack that scales, as they say. What's mean by that is, you know, the hackers can go and they can steal a million passwords. And if it's only passwords that are protecting you, they can then hack a million accounts and steal money from a million different people. But if you're, but if taking over an account depends on physically possessing their cell phone, then the attack won't scale. They, if they can steal a million passwords, fine, but then they have to steal a million cell phones if they're going to take over a million accounts. And so it's going to make these massive, large-scale attacks
data much breaches more difficult. And the like much more difficult.
Yeah, or much, even if the data breach happens, it will be much less consequential because you won't be able to exploit all of the passwords you've just stolen because people won't really be using passwords. They'll be using the fact that their cell phone is the cell phone they registered with their real ID. And that's
So when you, Congressman, when you explain all this, I keep hearing one word going over it in my head over and over and over, and that's data. And you and I see each other at many groundbreaking ceremonies for data centers throughout DuPage County and throughout the 11th District. This is clearly going to require more data, which is going to require more data centers, which is going to require more energy, which is going to require more everything. What is the government? What are you guys doing?
Well, yeah, what we're doing right now is we're monetizing the fact that we have a very high quality grid in Illinois and a very large amount of carbon-free energy in the form of nuclear power. The estimates are that something like 20% of all of the energy, of the electricity that we consume is going to be used in data centers. And so that's something like 5 gigawatts of power just for Northern Illinois to feed all the data centers that people anticipate. There's a lot of uncertainty on how big that will be because the algorithms keep getting better. That, you know, right now for, you know, ChatGPT, it takes, you know, thousands of hours on large data centers to train that model. But then what happens is that people look at it and say, okay, most of what that data center is doing when it's training these large language models is, you know, multiplying zero by zero. And why don't we make algorithms that just don't waste their time doing that and do the important part of the calculation? And they find that they can accomplish the same thing with 1/10 or 1/100th the amount of power. So that's part of the horse race that's going on. A lot of people are saying that we're just going to need massive new investments in our energy ecosystem, including nuclear. There's a lot of the AI money is now being diverted into nuclear plants around the country.
What about small nuclear reactors?
Well, that is the great hope, and that really changes the fully financed cost of these plants.
And is there a quicker approval? These things require federal approval, I'm assuming.
Oh, yeah. And local approval.
And local approval. And is there things that you're working on in Congress to kind of shorten that window? Because if I had a nickel for every developer who told me that the lead time on getting their data center up and running is pushing 3 years now, and some of it has to do with approvals and regulations, is there anything that we're looking at or you're looking at to kind of shorten that lead time so that we can meet the demands of the business community?
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things is the way AI is being used to accelerate that process.
That's crazy, isn't it? You're using AI to solve your own problem.
I had a long discussion with a developer who specializes in doing all the civil construction for big AI data centers. And he says when he delivers one of these big box buildings with all the power and everything inside it, he also delivers what he describes as a telephone book full of documentation that says, yes, here is how the roof won't collapse in this big a snowstorm. Here's how the wind loading. Here's the power consumption, you know, how well insulated it is. And so he has a team of currently 30 people that do nothing but produce the telephone book for every data center. And so now they've started to use AI and they find that really what he needs is a 3-person team to review the results of what AI produces for that telephone book for every.
Good to know.
And so it's sort of where AI is going to be going all over our economy. What you're going to see is things will get cheaper because fewer people will be required to make them. And then you have to figure out, okay, what do all of the people who used to spend their time, producing the telephone book for every data center? I saw what was to me a little bit startling and frightening demonstration a couple months back where it was about architecture. And the way it works was that, okay, here's my plot of land. And here's where the sewer connections and the electrical connections. Here's where I want my driveway. And then you just told the AI architect, now I would like a house in the style of Frank Lloyd Wright with 5 bedrooms and 3 bathrooms. And then you waited 30 seconds and then plunk. It would draw, and it would go plunk. Every 30 seconds, put down another design that looked like a Frank Lloyd Wright house from different periods in its architectural style. And then when you're all happy, it would give you the complete bill of materials and the bid package necessary to send it out to contractors. Sure. And so my reaction when I saw that, besides, wow, is this neat, is what does that mean to an architecture student
Sure.
who has graduated from architecture school with a whole pile of student debt? Mm-hmm. And you're seeing the conversation that a consumer would have with their architect mm-hmm. being done with a conversation to a machine and producing essentially the same result, but much more rapidly.
Yeah.
And that's, we're not ready for this.
Yeah. Congressman, I want to talk about small business in a minute, but just one last question on this topic. The PsiQuantum deal over at 87th and the Lake, I know that you were involved in that. And mm-hmm. we in DuPage County stood side by side with our friends at World Business Chicago and Intersect Illinois and the governor's office because we recognized the economic impact that that's going to have on the region. What are your thoughts about quantum computing going to Chicago? Are we really positioning ourselves as the go-to place for quantum computing? Is this going to have ramifications throughout your district and throughout the region?
Well, one of the reasons that PsiQuantum wanted to locate in Chicago area is that you had the tremendous universities and laboratories. So when they want to build a big cryogenic system, well, guess what? That's what Fermilab has done for decades. And so we have the relevant expertise in a number of areas. The PsiQuantum, I'm particularly happy with our choice of getting involved with them because, as the PhD physicist in Congress, every one of these quantum startups comes up and knocks on my door until I have a meeting. And almost all of them, with I think 2 exceptions, they sort of triggered my BS alarm. That I said, okay, look, this is hype. What are the algorithms you're actually going to do? What is your roadmap to making a useful quantum computer? And that was got into arm waving instead of our detailed plans. It wasn't like that with PsiQuantum. I think we had a 15-minute meeting that lasted an hour and a half when they came in because this may not be BS. They had a detailed plan. They had working prototypes of the key elements, and they're just in the process of putting it together. And the fact that they're willing to and have found investors to actually deploy a significant scale quantum device in the south side of Chicago or anywhere in the Chicago area sort of confirms the result of my BS detector.
Yeah.
There were multiple competitive sites, including mm-hmm. some in the Illinois 11th District. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing is for us to recognize that we're all in this together. And the whole Chicagoland area doesn't have the reputation it deserves. I'm always struck. Yeah, well, I was struck that there's every year for the last 11 years, they've had this quiet announcement that the Chicago metro area is number one for businesses relocating into it. All right. And they do that because you look at a map and you say, it makes sense to be located, just south of Lake Michigan. And it's, and you look at all the transportation going into it. And there's a reason that Chicago Metro exists and where it is. And
changing that narrative and helping to tell that message is really important because sometimes you just got to do the simple blocking and tackling things to help move the needle. Let's talk small business just for a minute. What are your small businesses in the 11th Congressional District telling you from a federal perspective that they'd like to see more of and kind of what's happening in D.C. from a small business perspective? You started as a small business, grew it to a larger business, probably with those numbers may probably still classified as a small business. It's an ESOP. What are you hearing from your small business?
I don't know. I think 1,300 employees, I wouldn't call
mid-size?
That small. mid-size, but yeah. There's this point. And when I was running it, it was small. Mm-hmm. But you still reach this point where you sort of drive into the shop in the morning and you look at the parking lot and you say, look at all of these families that that depend on the jobs we provide, and
right.
And boy, we better not screw up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a kind of I don't know. It's thrilling and it's terrifying at the same point to be a small or even medium-sized businessman. But it's interesting. There's a lot of technological muscle in this area that's really fun to watch. You know, there's actually a startup it's in Geneva, the technology was developed at Argonne. And what they've done is they've figured out this company, it's called ClearFlame, and they figured out how to crack the code on making a diesel engine that works with full thermodynamic efficiency on corn ethanol. Now, this is something that people have been trying and failing at for 100 years. I mean, you know, Henry Ford, had a set of cars that he tried to market that ran on moonshine, which the engines weren't very good, and he discontinued it. There were a couple of recent college graduates, so they went to Argonne National Lab. They proved their concept worked on a one-cylinder test engine that Argonne had, with a lot of help from the Argonne engineering force. And then they got Cummins to get them an old diesel engine, and they converted the diesel engine and showed it worked on an actual truck engine. And now they've got something like 18 different trucks that are out on the field proving they get the mileage. It saves about 20 to 25% in fuel costs for truckers, which is a big deal if you're a trucking company.
Good stuff.
And it's 100 times less soot. That the pollution aspect is great. And John Deere gave them a $17 million contract. John Deere intends to develop an entire line of tractors and combines and farm equipment that runs on corn ethanol. So you have the possibility of a fully self-contained farm economy from an energy point of view that will have no carbon footprint, because the tractors will be running on ethanol that comes from the carbon dioxide in the air. That's
all from small business. That's good stuff. Anything going on in the committees that you sit on, or the subcommittees that our listeners should be aware of, whether it's financial institutions, we talked a little bit about that, and digital assets or national security? What are we going to see in Congress in a post-election environment, and what's kind of on your wish list or your watch list?
Well, you know, I entered Congress in March of 2008, right before the economy collapsed. And, you know, when I looked around and watched the collapse, I said, how did people ever do, you know, this level of stupidity? You know, you had these giant investment banks where they closed the book every night, levered 30-1, so that if they woke up the next morning and their assets had dropped by 3% in value, they were wiped out, which is in fact what happened when mortgage-backed securities dropped by more than 3% basically overnight. And so So one of the things that I feel is my job on the Financial Services Committee, depending on how the election turns out, I'm either going to be the chair or the ranking member on the subcommittee with oversight over all banking and monetary policy.
Okay.
And so my goal in that is to make sure that I die before we have another financial crisis.
Well, let's hope that's many, 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 many years from now. Congressman, I always like to ask my guest for kind of a future thinking or maybe one prediction. And for you, with your experience, have we seen the soft landing? Are we going to have a soft landing? And no one's going to hold you to this. This is just a friendly little DuPage County podcast. But what's your thoughts on where we're at right now?
Macroeconomic? Well, look at, you know, the United States did not escape the inflation that hit every single country on earth. And any politician that tells you, oh, if I was in charge, we would not have had inflation, it's nonsense. Okay. But what we did avoid was to have a recession as we came out of COVID. And that was because of the strong federal intervention in the economy. And so that's why we have unemployment basically at historically low levels. And it's, you know, it's, and anything around 4% is pretty, it's, you can't get much more healthy than that. Unemployment can never be zero because people are always jumping jobs in a healthy economy and spending part of their time looking for the next job. But 4% is a good number for unemployment. And the latest numbers on inflation, it's come back to baseline, which is sort of the definition of a soft landing.
Yeah. Okay. So, Congressman, I've said it before, I'll say it again. You've been a friend of Choose DuPage. You've been a friend of DuPage County from a business perspective. You're always there when we ask you to meet with a business or work with a business that's looking to grow and expand. And as I mentioned, being an organization that tries to stay out of politics, we recognize the important role that political leaders play in the business environment in DuPage. And you've always been a friend of DuPage, and we thank you for the support and everything that you've given Choose DuPage and the DuPage County business community over the years.
Well, thank you. I think helping recruiting business into the area, it's an important part of the job. And when you have a member of Congress that can actually look other businessmen in the eye and say, here's why moving to DuPage is a good deal for you, that is one of the things I'm most proud of being able to bring to this job.
As you should be. And I can't tell you what I really mean this sincerely, whether it's an elected official at the federal level, state level, local level, having them just show up and just say, we want you here, and we are going to work to make sure that your needs are met, really matters in my world of trying to attract those businesses and put them in your lap to help you and others close that deal. So that's it for today's show. Congressman, thank you so much for joining me. We really appreciate it. As always, thank you to our friends at the College of DuPage for supporting today's episode. To keep up with what's happening in DuPage County and the Chicagoland region, follow Choose DuPage on social media or visit choosedupage.com. I'm Greg Bedlove. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the DuPage Business Beat.